The wreckage of the EMN ships floated still and silent above Solomon's radiant atmosphere. Seeing the dark outlines of our ruined ships, I wondered how much the people on the planet understood. So close to the atmosphere, the space battle would have been visible through civilian telescopes and traffic radars. Some of the explosions might have been visible to the naked eye. Could the people have known that the battle signaled their planet's demise? Did they know that the bad guys had won, and that the darkened carcasses above their planet were ships that had come to protect them?
Ah, damn, they got our ships.
Mystery solved. I sat on the bridge, an invited guest of Captain Holman. We slowed to a near crawl as we circled the remains of the ships. The first wreck we passed was a frigate, a small ship designed to block fighter attacks. I identified the frigate by her size. The Unified Authority's killer torpedoes had smashed every other recognizable feature from the hull. The moth-shaped frame had exploded into three separate sections, still connected by a few shreds of metal. The nose of the ship was a jagged twist. No light shone from its remains, not even the flicker of electricity.
These ships came from the Perseus Outer Fleet. I served in that fleet.
Behind the frigate, the other ships assigned to the patrol looked equally demolished. They showed in silhouette only, dark and dead, silent forms floating over the sunlit sphere of Solomon.
Captain Holman, I've located two UA battleships.
We should introduce ourselves.
Naval battles. As the ship goes, so does every man aboard her. I had my share of phobias. Nukes and naval battles were at the top of my list.
You okay, General Harris? You look a little pale.
I didn't answer. Better to let him wonder if I was nervous than let him hear it in my voice. Moving slowly, we came around, circling the wreckage so that we were between the dead ships and the planet. We were so small. As we passed the ruins of a battleship, I realized that there was more than enough room for us to park on one of her busted wings. A few moments passed, then I spotted them, two small shapes glowing like phosphorescent sea creatures as they came around the planet. It was always possible that they had spotted us. Our ship was a spy ship and had the finest stealth technology that the Unifieds had developed, but it used Unified Authority technology. Could they really have been so stupid as to create stealth generators without also developing a technology for seeing through the cloak? The UA ships showed no signs of detecting us. They held their ground as we approached them.
Captain, there's a third ship about 80,000 miles away, halfway around the planet.
Good to know. General, do you care which ship we sink first?
It's your show.
Fire blue pill!
Blue torpedo away.
Fire red pill!
Red torpedo away, sir.
Now bring us around!
We attacked that first ship from a few hundred miles out. It took the torpedoes a couple of seconds to cover the distance. The first torpedo struck, splashing a wave of electricity that arced along the shields. But the shields remained along the UA ship, like a translucent skin. 3 seconds later, the red torpedo struck, a brilliant light that popped and vanished, leaving the ship untouched.
Fire another blue!
Aye, aye. Torpedo away.
Fire another one after that! Helm, steer us below the target!
I traced the small blue dots on the tactical display, then turned to the viewport in time to see the torpedoes hit their mark, one right after another. The first pill struck, creating a flash that splashed across the shield. Before the first flash disappeared, the second torpedo renewed it. This time, the blinding bright light engulfed the entire ship. Then the third torpedo struck. The torpedoes were powerful, no doubt, but so were the new shields on those ships. The torpedoes did damage, but they weren't battering their shields as thoroughly as they had battered ours. The tent shields spread, leaving the viewport as dark as a mirror in a room with no light, its shiny surface reflecting light from the bridge, but the viewport itself was opaque.
Hard about! Put us on top of them!
Our torpedoes might or might not have destroyed the UA ship. Either way, she wasn't moving. We could no longer see the scene on the viewport. The tent shields were too thick. The circle marking that ship on the tactical display remained as still as an island. Our attack must have caught the other two ships unawares. All three ships remained perfectly still for half a minute.
Captain, two of the ships are approaching fast.
While the ship we had hit remained listless, her mates circled the area, randomly firing lasers into pockets of space as they groped in the darkness to find us.
What do you know? They can't see through their own stealth technology.
Did you think they might be able to?
They still might. They might also have a code that shuts down our generator.
To prevent someone from turning their own technology against them.
Exactly right. Right now, they're looking for a needle in a haystack and hoping they'll get lucky.
But they won't?
They'd need to get very lucky. We're a moving target and we're invisible. We'll be safe as long as we don't do anything that gives away our position.
What would give away our position?
Launching a transport would give us away. Fire a red at the crippled ship!
Torpedo away, sir.
Fire another one!
Aye, aye.
Helm, down and away!
The tactical showed the UA battleships as shapes, not ships. The circles representing the live ships had been moving like the hands of a clock, circumscribing a circular pattern, firing lasers while sniffing for targets. Once we launched the torpedoes, both ships streaked in our direction. The dot representing our ship scurried to safety as the first of our red torpedoes struck the target ship, then the second. Moments passed, and the tent shields evaporated from the viewport. At first, I could not tell what I was looking at.
Hell yeah!
The final torpedoes had penetrated the crippled ship's shields. The Unified Authority battleship sat battered and lifeless, but not destroyed.
We could finish her.
She looks done. After this point, it's not combat, it's murder.
That's what they did to our ships.
Yeah? They're murderers.
Power up the broadcast engine. We're going home.
What about Solomon?
General, there are still two more battleships out there. They're on high alert. They will destroy us and the transport if we try to launch.
He was right. So were Leota and Wallace. They'd been right all along. 7 million people would die on Solomon. We could not evacuate the planet. We need to send a warning.
Those UA ships can trace our signals.
I tried to convince myself that it was for the best. We could never have saved more than a small fraction of the population. By leaving them in ignorance, we would allow the people of Solomon to live their last few hours in peace. They would not know they'd been incinerated until God told them what had happened. It wasn't a bad way to go, I suppose, but I didn't feel good about letting it happen. On the surface, Freeman appeared to take the news about leaving Solomon with cold indifference. I told him about the Unified Authority ships and the battle, and he listened in silence. His expression remained impassive, as slack as a death mask. His eyes bored right through me. I asked Holman about warning them.
Unifieds would track the signal. Even if they got the message, we wouldn't save many people. Dust to dust.
We stood together in the kettle of the transport, a large metal cavern with steel girder ribs along its iron walls. Freeman wore his custom-made battle armor with his helmet off. I had come in my Charlie service uniform. Let the dead bury the dead. The words woke Freeman from his stupor.
What is that supposed to mean?
It means that we can kill ourselves trying to warn people, but we cannot save them. They will spend their last hours humping girlfriends, fishing, reading, going to the specking ballet, doing whatever it is they like to do. I'd rather go that way than spend my last hours panicking about death.
As I said this, I thought about mothers holding their children. What does a mother do when she learns that all of her children will die at the end of the day? Does she tuck them into bed and tell them a story? I had no concept of what it meant to lose family. Freeman did. His father, a Neo-Baptist minister, died defending his colony. The Avatari had burned Freeman's last relations when they attacked New Copenhagen. I was haunted by my imagination. He was haunted by his memories. Solomon was a lost cause. Freeman, big as he was, standing there so still and silent, reminded me of a spider on a web in some abandoned archway. I was a weakling and he was a spider, and we lived in a universe that was crumbling around us. He spun webs and I made plans, but we were feeble. Neither his webs nor my plans mattered in the end. There is nothing I hate more than the feeling of helplessness, I told myself, but it was not the truth. I hated the Unified Authority more than I hated feeling helpless, and I hated the Avatari more than anything else. Earth date, November 26, AD 2517. Location, planet A361b. Galactic position, solar system A361. Astronomic location, Bodis Galaxy. Under normal circumstances, the pilot of the first transport was a talkative man. So were the two technicians. But flying a mission they all expected to result in their deaths, They had lost interest in chatting. From 1 million miles out, planet A361b looked like a very small moon. Each hour brought them 200,000 miles closer to their destination, and from their current position, the pilot could see that the planet was the color of platinum rather than the dull white of a moon. He sat alone in the cockpit. His orders were to fire the pods from just outside the ion curtain. Yamashiro's orders made it clear that firing the pods from 1 million miles away wasn't an option, however much it was a temptation. The pilot made no effort to control the flight. He'd switched the computers to autopilot and spent the time slumped in his seat, reviewing his life. He thought about his failures and successes, remembered his parents, relived the pain of his young wife's death, and wondered what life might have been like had she lived. He had no children. From 5,000 miles away, planet A361b filled the cockpit's windshield. He realized that he didn't see the planet, just the sleeve that had closed around its atmosphere. From the outside, it looked like a solid layer, like someone had dipped the planet in white gold.
We're here. We're almost in position. Let's make this quick.
The pilot did not hesitate as he worked the controls. Maybe the aliens could target the oxygen in his armor, or maybe they would target the air in his lungs and sear him from the inside out. It no longer mattered. All that mattered was the mission, and the pilot would give his life and the lives of his technicians to see it through. He switched off the controls for what he believed would be the very last time and walked out of the cockpit. In the kettle, the technicians had already loaded the SIPs into the launching device, but had not yet pulled the device into position. As the pilot watched from the catwalk, one of the techs hit the button to open the hatch. Standing on his perch above the kettle, the pilot could not see the ramp. His curiosity got the better of him, and he slid down the ladder. He had not turned off the gravity inside the transport, just notched it down to about 1/3 gravity level on Earth. He touched down lightly on the metal deck, turned, and saw the far end of the ship. The rear hatch framed the view of A361B, glinting like a giant shining sphere of molten silver. As the pilot watched, the technicians pulled the launching device along a rail that ran down the ramp. When it locked into place at the bottom of the ramp, blocking his view of the planet, the pilot went even closer. In the distance, he could see the second transport still drifting into position, its rear hatch open. From initiation to completion, the firing process took 5 seconds. Once the launching device was in place, a technician pressed a button, and the device fired the SIPs into space. Knowing there was no point in trying to escape, the crew stood in place and watched. They could not see the infiltration pods. Powered by field resonance engines, the pods traveled the 5,000 miles to the planet in a fraction of a second. Nothing happened. The SIPs did not explode. The air in their rebreathers did not heat up to thousands of degrees. They stood there, at the edge of the transport, staring out at the planet, realizing that nothing had or would happen. They would return to the Sakura, having failed their mission and survived. The technicians slid the launching device back in place, and the pilot began the long flight back.
We cannot go back to Earth. There's no going back if the Unified Authority is at war. They shoot us down before we can identify ourselves.
Commander Suzuki now sat at the table. This had once been a room for admirals and captains. Now it had space for commanders and enlisted men. Master Chief Corey Oliver sat at the table. Yamashiro harbored no prejudice against clones. He did not care about the Master Chief's synthetic conception. His rank was another story. Oliver was a Master Chief Petty Officer, an enlisted man, and that, by definition, placed him below real officers.
We cannot destroy the enemy, and we cannot return to Earth. It sounds like we have run out of options.
No. We can still destroy the enemy.
Yamashiro turned to study the seal. He was not surprised when Oliver gave him a slight nod.
How can we do that? We fired our most powerful weapon at their shield, and it failed. If infiltration pods can't break through, nothing can.
I intend to detonate the pods from inside the lair. We'll broadcast the ship into the atmosphere.
They'll melt us like they melted the Onoda.
They won't. If we broadcast the Sakura inside the atmosphere, they will not be able to incinerate us without incinerating themselves.
Broadcast inside the sleep? That would not be possible. Nothing gets through the sleeve.
We would not broadcast through it. We would materialize inside it. We are honor-bound to succeed. This is the only way that we can.
Takahashi did not believe he had heard his father-in-law correctly. Stunned, he reviewed the sentence in his head.
Admiral, we won't be able to fly our ship once we are inside. The sleeve grounded the UA Air Force during the battle for Copenhagen. The fighter pilots weren't able to fly higher than 1,000 feet before their jets stopped working. The same thing will happen to us. Our computers, our electrical systems, our defenses. We'll be just as vulnerable as those fighters were, with less room to maneuver.
Yamashiro responded with a smile so sour that his son-in-law looked away.
No, Hironobu. We won't need to worry about that. We won't live long enough for it to be a factor. The information we are going to discuss is classified.
Yamashiro had received the information 24 hours ago, but postponed the briefing until he had time to compose his thoughts. Yamashiro did not hold the briefing in the conference room just off the bridge, the place he normally conducted business. The conference room was secure, but secure was not secure enough, not when the discussion involved the destruction of the Sakura and her crew. He held the briefing in the small office attached to his billet. Yamashiro presided over the briefing, but it was Lieutenant Tatsuhara's show. As the intelligence officer who ran the computer simulations, Hara supplied the critical information. Tatsuhara was young and tall and skinny, a man in his early 20s, with the moon-shaped face of a 16-year-old. His hair was regulation length, short at the back and off the ears. But his inch-long locks had been pressed into tight curls and bleached brown and blonde. He lived on the edge of regulations. Brantus, a tattooing process that involved burning the skin, then tinting the scar, of lotus flowers, kanji characters, women, and demons covered his arms and neck. He wore dark glasses and, as he stood, paused 1 second to remove them before opening his mouth, then placed the shades in the pocket of his blouse. The man was an officer, but also a gangster. The Brantus, the hair, and the shades were the tokens of the Yakuza. Lieutenant Hara briefly explained his responsibilities as a computer simulations specialist in intelligence, then spent a few minutes explaining the simulations process. Without giving any explanation, Hara ran the video feed of a battleship, probably the Kyoto, imploding. The holographic image appeared in the space above Yamashiro's desk, cropped tight to display every detail of the destruction.
Lieutenant, we've all seen this feed.
Maybe you have not seen this particular simulation, sir.
Hara slowed the feed, so that the attack occurred over a period of nearly 2 minutes. As the initial hit began, the hull of the ship expanded ever so slightly. Hara pressed a button on his computer, and the outer hull of the ship faded, revealing its inner workings.
I only finished running this simulation an hour ago.
The simulation showed the destruction inside the ship. Screens and panels exploded. Tables and cabinets and engines caught fire. Floors and bulkheads melted. Before the entire cataclysm could erupt, however, the outer skin of the ship turned to liquid, smothering everything inside it.
This is a simulation of what happens to a battleship when the air inside it heats up to 10,000 degrees.
Hara tapped the screen of his clipboard computer. This time the simulation of the inside of the ship appeared side by side with the feed of the outside of the ship. In the simulated ship, the air glowed red to signal the beginning of the attack.
You can see that the details match up.
He froze the display, pointed to several areas.
If you look here, the heat causes the air and metal inside the ship to expand.
What about the crew? Were they alive at this point?
I did not include the effects on humans in this simulation.
What is your best guess, Lieutenant?
Maybe they did not live this long. They probably died in less than a second. This is just a guess.
Hara finished the demonstration, showing how the ship first expanded from the heat, then air escaped through her melting walls without the cold of space lowering the heat inside her hull. With her frame melting, the battleship quickly collapsed in on herself and became a bubbling liquid cloud before being cooled by the vacuum of space.
We experimented with dozens of variables. This simulation came the closest to what we saw during the attack on the Kyoto. It's not a perfect match, but it comes close.
Your simulation does not explain what they used to attack the ships.
No, sir. We don't know how they delivered the heat to the ship.
Oh, So that is still unknown?
Yes, sir.
Hara tapped the screen of his computer, and a new image appeared above the desk. The image of a wasted city.
Is this a simulation?
No, Captain. This is a video feed from a satellite. This is what we found when we arrived at New Copenhagen.
The image showed burned buildings and streets lined with buildings that had been both charred and smashed.
Sir, we have no idea what kind of weapon they have used, but it generates a lot of heat within an atmosphere. I used my computer to simulate the destruction on New Copenhagen, and it is in keeping with what happened to our ships.
Show us the simulation, Lieutenant.
I apologize, sir, but I did not create an animated model.
What does that mean?
The simulation predicted what might happen to a planet if you raised its temperature to 10,000 degrees without generating a visual display.
What would happen?
You would incinerate plants, melt streets, melt anything made of plastic, steel, or glass, evaporate streams.
Hara ran the video feed of New Copenhagen, then stopped it on an image of a broken skyscraper.
This building is broken down to its base. It appears to have been crushed. In my computer simulation, the high temperatures caused the planet's atmosphere to rise like a hot air balloon. Buildings that survived the heat were smashed when the temperature returned to normal, and the atmosphere fell back into place.
Would it be possible for someone to survive on that planet?
Survive? Admiral, these temperatures...
No. Not during the attack. Now, if we place people on New Copenhagen, would they survive?
There are no plants to generate oxygen. I'm not sure if you could plant crops in this soil. The temperatures may have burned the nutrients out of the soil. That's just a guess. You probably would not have to worry about germs. This is not my area of expertise, sir.
Yes, I know. Lieutenant, we no longer have the luxury of sticking to our specialties. I would not be the admiral of a one-ship fleet if we did.
Yes, sir.
In your opinion, Lieutenant, could a colony survive on that planet?
I don't know, sir.
What about a breathable atmosphere?
I have no way of knowing, sir.
What would be your best guess?
Sir, your opinion would be as good as mine.
What do you know?
The radiation levels on the planet are manageable. My simulation predicted no rise in radiation.
From what you are now telling me, it appears that a colony might stand a chance of survival.
Yes, sir. It might.
Life on the Sakura was divided into three shifts. Most of the crew worked 8-hour shifts. They had 8 hours to eat, drink, clean their billets, and relax. And they had 8 hours to sleep. Lieutenant Tatsuhara lived by his own schedule. He put in his full 8-hour work detail, sometimes extending his shifts to 12 when needed. A man of infinite energy, Hara only slept 3 to 4 hours per day. He spent the rest of his time running his businesses. He now sat in the back of his most profitable bar, thinking about the future. Unlike the officers' clubs, this bar was dark and quiet, a romantic place only a few doors from the hourly hotel. Soft music played over the speakers, hanging in the air like the scent of perfume. The door opened, and in the light from the hall, he saw the silhouette of a short man with a bald head. The seals did not walk like other men. They glided with the sinewy grace of a cat on the prowl. He was alone. No woman, no friends. He walked into the bar, selected a small open table, and sat facing Hara. A second passed, and Hara walked over to the table. Hara was not the only Yakuza on the ship. He had 15 men in his organization. There had been more. 3 had stolen drugs from the infirmary and tried to sell them. 1 had beaten a female sailor. All 4 men had disappeared. Hara believed that the seals killed them. Hiding a body on a ship might be hard, but you could always dump it into space. When he looked into the cold, dark eyes of the seal, eyes hidden in shadows under that bony ridge of brow, Hara saw the eyes of a man for whom murder came easily.
Master Chief, I'm surprised to see you here.
Lieutenant, I hope I am welcome here.
It's an open bar, Master Chief. Men, women, officers, enlisted men. It's open to everyone.
Even clones?
Are you waiting for a date?
No.
Mind if I join you?
The seal waved at a seat, and Hara sat. He signaled to the waitress and ordered 2 glasses of single malt scotch, speaking in Japanese. Then he turned to the seal. He still spoke in Japanese.
Do you want yours on ice?
The seal pretended not to understand it.
I know you speak Japanese.
Mizude desu.
The waitress bowed and went to get the drinks.
Water?
I'm not much of a drinker.
When did you learn to speak Japanese?
After we left Earth. How did you know I could speak?
I watch more carefully than Admiral Yamashiro or Captain Takahashi.
You watch me more closely?
I watch everything more closely.
The waitress returned. She gave Hara a five-finger tumbler with scotch over ice. She gave Oliver a glass of water. She was a pretty girl with long hair and a dark complexion. Before leaving, she smiled at Oliver and nodded at Hara. Oliver touched the water to his lips. He might have taken a small sip. Hara could not tell.
You aren't thirsty. Then why did you come to a bar?
Why do you think?
How did you know where to find me?
I'm like you, Lieutenant. I'm watchful.
We don't see the Kage no Yashai in our bars very often.
Yes, we shadow demons prefer to remain in our lair.
You know that term as well. I was looking forward to translating it for you.
Sorry to disappoint you.
Hara noticed there was something different in the seal's demeanor, and it made him nervous.
What did you want to discuss, Master Chief?
Hara fumbled to slip the thumb of his left hand into the sleeve of his shirt. Hidden in the cuff, he had a panic button. By pressing it, he sent a distress signal to the other Yakuza.
I came to let you in on a secret. Would you like to know what we talked about after you left the meeting?
As a matter of fact, I am curious about that. But, Master Chief, isn't that restricted information?
Oliver did not respond to the question. Hara watched as the door of the bar opened. With his back to that door, Oliver did not see the two brantued sailors enter the bar. His eyes hidden behind dark glasses, Hara watched the men as they quietly slipped into a nearby booth.
We're heading back to New Copenhagen. Yamashiro wants to start a colony.
On New Copenhagen? That cinder of a planet might sustain life, but it would not be a life worth living.
No one is calling it the Garden of Eden.
What about the ship they saw, the one that chased us away? What will he do if that ship returns?
We hit it with our best weapon. We have plenty of stealth infiltration pods.
You do realize that that was a unified authority ship. Does Yamashiro really want to fire on a UA ship?
We could always broadcast to Earth and ask the Unified Authority if the ship belongs to them.
A man and a woman entered the bar. Hara did not care about the couple, but he was glad to see that there were three men with brantued necks and dark glasses waiting outside the door, along with the two who had entered the bar. For the first time since the conversation began, the lieutenant allowed his thumb to drop from the panic button.
I don't understand why we are returning to the Orion Arm at all. We have not completed our mission. Is the old man admitting defeat?
We still have a way of getting around the Ion Curtain. You're a betting man. I'll wager you've run a simulation of it.
Broadcasting the Sakura into their atmosphere? I've run the simulation. The ship won't survive long. It's suicide.
Good thing we're leaving all non-essential personnel on New Copenhagen.
Where they will starve to death if they don't suffocate first.
Where they will have a chance of surviving.
Why are you telling me this?
I am here to let you know that you will not be joining the colony.
Did Yamashiro send you?
No. I came on my own.
And I see that you came alone.
I hoped we could keep this between us.
A gentleman's agreement?
Something like that.
You want me to go down with the ship?
Consider it seppuku, if you like.
You are not a pilot or a weapons technician. Doesn't that make you non-essential personnel? Do you plan on committing seppuku as well?
I'm staying on the ship.
You can commit suicide if you want. Why should I?
Because there will not be room for serpents in the Garden of Eden. The colony won't have room for gambling or prostitution or vice lords. There won't be time for gangsters or secret organizations.
Hara nodded to the men behind Oliver. Watching his men rise to their feet and walk to the table, Hara felt a wave of relief wash over him.
You think I'm a gangster?
I think you are one of the losers.
The losers?
Yakuza. 893. I believe it refers to a losing hand in cards.
Very good. You have a good grasp of Japanese.
One of the men laid a hand on Oliver's shoulder and pressed the tip of his butterfly knife into the seal's back. Corey Oliver did not flinch. He did not move. His eyes remained fixed on Hara's.
You have decided that I should die with the ship, and I have decided that you do not have the right to make that decision. If you go out quietly, we won't need to eliminate witnesses.
No more words passed between Hara and Oliver. While his men escorted the clone out of the bar, Hara returned to his table at the back. He felt no regret about what would happen to the seal. When you work both sides of the law, the occasional murder was a survival mechanism. He did not have time to think about Oliver. He needed to make plans for New Copenhagen. The seal had been correct. The name, Yakuza, did refer to a losing hand in cards. In Hara's mind, it was the losing hand that made the Yakuza the winners. In his mind, the Yakuza were not the ones who held the cards. They were the ones who dealt them. Hara's feeling of triumph turned cold when he saw the next two men who entered the bar, a pair of seals. With four of his men surrounding the seal and his knife pressed into the clone's back, Ricky Oshiro should have felt confident. They moved down an empty service hall in a pack, surrounding the seal. Oshiro and another man flanked the seal. The man bringing up the rear lagged 10 feet behind the pack. He carried an S9 pistol in his hand. If the seal made a move, he would shoot to kill. They turned into a service hall that led behind the mess area. The two men leading the pack turned a corner. Oshiro and the seal followed. And that was it. The last man never appeared. When Oshiro looked back to see what had happened, the seal broke his arm at the elbow and wrist. As the seal went for his next target, he shattered Oshiro's leg with a kick to the side of the knee. As Oshiro cowered in pain, the seal slid his talon-like fingers across the neck of the man on his right. The men in the front did not respond quickly enough to save themselves. The seal swept an ankle from under the man on the right, leaving him hobbled. Only one uninjured opponent remained. The man did not run. He had a gun, but he knew he could not draw it fast enough to save himself. He kicked at the seal, but the clone ducked, spun, and moved away. The man chased, his arms guarding his face, his fists clenched tight. As the seal came in range, Oshiro tried to kick him, but the seal dodged the kick, dropped to one leg, and struck the inside of Oshiro's injured knee with a back fist. Oshiro fought back the pain as he rolled toward the knife he had dropped. The seal leaped over his shoulder and drove the heel of his foot into the wounded Yakuza's neck. The uninjured Yakuza lunged at the seal, an aggressive mistake that ended the fight. Using his fingers like a knife, the seal drove his fingers into the man's neck. Only when the fighting had ended did the three seals behind the corner emerge with the body of the fifth Yakuza, the gunman.
Not exactly a textbook assault.
I just eliminated four men.
Senior Chief Warren looked incredulous.
Yes, and it wouldn't have been much louder if you had attacked them with a set of kettle drums and a bugle.
The other seals set to work without a word. They loaded the bodies onto a cart, which they rolled to the same waste disposal unit that the Yakuza would have used to incinerate Oliver. While Oliver and Warren mopped the floor and cleaned the walls, the bodies of the gangsters burned to ash. In less than 3 minutes, the SEALs cleaned the service hall and disposed of the bodies. They prided themselves on efficiency.
15 of my men are missing. What do you know about the disappearances, Master Chief?
Nothing, sir.
It was a lie, and Oliver knew that Yamashiro could see through it. But lying was within the parameters of his mission. Before leaving Earth, the SEALs had received special orders.
You know nothing about it? I think you and your men have been poaching.
Poaching, sir?
Hunting without permission.
Captain Takahashi sat in a corner of the office watching the interrogation, his expression flat.
I will not tolerate vigilantism on my ship.
Vigilantism, sir? Was somebody breaking the law?
The missing men are all Yakuza.
Permission to speak, sir.
Speak.
What are Yakuza?
Gangsters.
Lieutenant Tatsuhara is missing.
Hara?
The intelligence officer who spoke in the briefing yesterday.
The man with all the brantus.
Yes.
And the curled hair.
Yamashiro glowered.
And the dark glasses.
This time, Yamashiro did not respond at all.
Was he a gangster?
You were seen in Shin Roppongi Bar last night.
Me, sir?
You were seen.
What makes you think it was me? With all due respect, sir, there are 3,000 Navy SEALs on this ship, and we all look alike.
Hey. Do you think this is funny?
Yes, sir, I do.
I see no humor.
Admiral, when you left Earth, you were given orders that you have not shared with the rest of the crew. What makes you so sure Master Chief Oliver is not following special orders as well?
Is that the case, Master Chief?
This sailor has received no special orders, sir.
But you would not be able to tell me if Admiral Brochus gave you a direct order, would you?
Yamashiro turned back to Takahashi.
What kind of orders?
Orders to enforce unified authority regulations. Orders to do whatever he sees necessary to ensure we accomplish our mission.
This is not a unified authority ship.
But the SEALs are on loan from the UA Navy.
Admiral Brochus is the only officer who would have authority to issue those orders. Did you meet with Admiral Brochus? Tell me!
It could have come from the Linear Committee. It might have been an executive order.
Do you think the orders included assassinating members of my crew?
Naturally. They may include assassinating you, if necessary.
Maybe so. At ease, Master Chief. Do you believe I have shown good judgment as a commander, Master Chief?
Yes, sir.
We did not need those men, I suppose. Hara was a useful officer. Bootleggers and extortionists. Please, sit. Master Chief, what do you know about colonizing planets?
There was a notepad on Yamashiro's desk. He picked up the stylus and focused his attention on the small screen.
They didn't cover colonization in special operations, sir. I do have men who specialized in survival training.
Survival training?
Supplementing limited resources by living off the land, locating and purifying sources of water, building shelter, camouflage. Some of it could be useful.
We may need them for protection as well.
Master Chief, as you know, we're sending all non-essential personnel down to the planet. We will not need your SEALs to complete our mission. I want to leave them with the colony.
Yes, sir. I've thought about that, sir, and I believe that would be a mistake, sir.
You think I am making a mistake? Just yesterday, you recommended sending all non-essential personnel to New Copenhagen.
Yes, sir.
Have you changed your mind?
Not entirely, sir. I still believe we should establish a colony. I have had second thoughts about the size of the colony.
Everyone left aboard this ship will die. A-361B will be a kamikaze mission.
Yes, sir. Sir, resources are going to be scarce on New Copenhagen. It may take years before the colony becomes self-sufficient. I'm concerned about overpopulating the colony.
Who do you think we should leave on the colony?
Not me or my men, sir. I believe we have nothing to contribute to the colony.
Master Chief, once we program the broadcast coordinates into the broadcast computer, we can fly that mission with a skeleton crew. We won't need you on this mission.
What would we contribute to the colony? If the objective is to preserve life, to continue humanity, Admiral, we're clones. We're sterile. 100 of my men have been trained in basic survival tactics. They may be useful. They can serve as peacekeepers. They know how to build shelters and purify water. They can contribute. The colony will need farmers, not saboteurs. They didn't teach us farming and SEAL training. We don't belong in your colony.
You're a cheerful fellow. Do your men agree with your assessment?
To a man.
What do you suggest we do?
Leave our survival specialists on New Copenhagen.
And you think I should take the rest of you to A-361B?
Yes, sir.
You don't want to leave?
Sir. We were created to help ensure the survival of the human species. We want to do what we were created to do, sir. You will not need us in your colony, Admiral. Life in your colony does not fit our mission.
In my colony? It may not have occurred to you, Master Chief, but you are not the only man in this fleet who is willing to go down with this ship. I have no intention of hiding on a planet while my ship is destroyed.
You mean my ship. I command the ship. You command the fleet.
Which is down to one ship. Captain, the Sakura is my fleet.
With all due respect, Admiral, there is no fleet. There will be a colony and it will need a governor. You will be needed on New Copenhagen. Any part you would play during the destruction of A-361B would be insignificant. Your leadership in the colony, on the other hand...
I am more than 70 years old. Do not deny an old man the opportunity to die with dignity.
Takahashi stood and walked over to his father-in-law. He placed a hand on the old man's shoulder.
You are a miserable excuse for a fleet commander. You were a fantastic governor and a masterful politician. But I never liked the way you ran the fleet.
Yamashiro's shoulder tightened, then sagged.
Was it my fault? Was it my fault that we lost the other ships?
At some point, Takahashi had blamed Yamashiro for their losses. He had sided with the warlike Miyamoto instead of listening to his other captains. Now, though, Takahashi realized the weight of command and forgave.
No. It was nobody's fault.
The colony will need a government and laws. It will need a leader, someone who can tell the people not to eat more food than they can grow even though they are hungry.
That is not me.
That can only be you.
What about you?
You are the governor of a planet. I am the captain of this ship. Both of our futures have been decided for us. You will lead the colony, and I will protect it.
And die a hero.
Sometimes it is easier to die for your beliefs than to live for them. I think my job will be easier than yours.
35 stealth infiltration pods hovered in space, 10,000 miles away from the Sakura, forming a loose blockade around the ship. The technicians controlling the pods kept their field resonance engines fully charged and on the brink of overcharging. They were like grenades, keys pulled, and ready to throw. Theoretically, the enemy ships only needed to venture within 5,000 miles of one of the pods for the trap to work. When your bombs explode with enough force to shatter small planets, marksmanship is not really an issue. Within an hour of the Sakura drifting into place above New Copenhagen, three ships streaked into view. Three anomalies appeared behind the first ships, signaling the arrival of three more ships. Another trio of ships appeared on the opposite side of the Sakura.
First wave, support wave. Third wave to flank, cutting off retreat. Those must be Unified Authority ships. They're using the same tactics they used against the Mogads.
Who are they at war with? Why attack us? Are they responding to our signal?
No, sir.
Keep trying. Are they in range of the pods?
Almost, sir. They're flying very slowly. They drop down under 1,000 miles per hour.
Maybe they want us to escape.
Still no response.
Captain, we need to...
Takahashi knew his job.
Fire the nearest pod.
To the naked eye, it looked like nothing happened. If there was a flash from the explosion, it was so small that nothing showed on the monitors. There was no visible shockwave, no wall of debris. An uninformed observer might have thought that the three glowing ships had simply malfunctioned. In the invisible wake of the explosion, the three glowing ships slid sideways like boats caught by a powerful wave. Their bows continued to face toward the Sakura as they skittered to the side and began shedding parts. This wasn't a naval battle. It was like crushing an insect, thought Takahashi.
The other ships are leaving, sir.
On his tactical display, Takahashi watched six glowing ships disappear into anomalies. After leaving the bridge, Admiral Yamashiro and Captain Takahashi stood in the control tower of one of the landing bays. Below them, lines of sailors, both men and women, marched onto transports.
It's like watching prisoners on their way to a firing squad. They think they are the ones who are going to die.
Is living easier than dying?
Your crew would mutiny if they knew what you planned. You, Hironobu, you are the brave one. You know where you are going and what you need to do.
My mission will end 3 minutes after it begins. There is no need for bravery.
For the first time in 3 years, Yamashiro smiled at his son-in-law.
You cannot convince me that flying a kamikaze mission over an alien planet is the act of a coward.
There is much you do not know.
Takahashi Hironobu, who could not return to his wife on Earth and was about to lose his ship, took comfort in the thought of a quick death. For the first time in his short life, Senior Chief Jeff Harmer raised his voice.
Me? Why do I have to go?
They convened in a small room, the 10 senior chiefs sitting in a single row of chairs, all looking exactly alike. Each man was short, 5 feet and 2 inches tall, with a charcoal-colored tint to his skin and a bald head.
Are you refusing to follow a direct command?
No, Master Chief, it's just... Master Chief, why are you assigning me this duty?
What is your MOS, Senior Chief?
Special reconnaissance.
And your training included?
Survival tactics.
And?
Geographical assessment.
And?
An assault planning and damage assessment.
You have an appropriate skill set, so you go. You and a company of SEALs will work as survival specialists, policemen, and drill sergeants. Once a sustainable living situation is achieved, you will train the colonists in defensive tactics.
Nursemaids.
Protectors. You will report to your transport in 30 minutes, Harmer. Go prep your men.
Harmer nodded. He rose to his feet and walked out of the room without saying a word. If everything went right, if the crops grew, and they found enough oxygen and water, Harmer and his men would serve as policemen and soldiers until they were too old to matter. Then they would go on for years, eating food meant for reproducing humans, outcasts, weak and alone among a tribe of people who cared for them only because they felt indebted. The thought made Oliver cringe. He could not imagine a worse fate.
I'll tell you what. If any of you are having second thoughts about returning to A361B, Harmer will switch places with you. Any takers?
No one raised a hand. No one spoke.
No one?
They sat in their chairs, staring up at Oliver, the ugliest men the Master Chief had ever seen.
Captain Takahashi tells me he can fly this ship with 120 men.
That doesn't seem like enough.
That's just what it takes to keep this ship flying. It takes an additional 200 men to keep things running in a battle situation. That's 320 trained sailors. For this mission, he's got 1,000 sailors and us. Admiral Yamashiro is taking most of the bridge crew with him to New Copenhagen. We're taking the old and the sick sailors with us.
Are any women coming with us?
No, Billings. No women. No young men either. The average age on this boat just jumped from 29 to 36.
Are you factoring us in those statistics?
I factored you animals in as 26-year-olds. Factoring you in as 5-year-olds, the average age drops to 25. You should have seen what happened to the average IQ on the ship when I factored you animals in. We cut it in half.
Transferring 2,200 colonists, 1,000 women, 1,100 men, and 100 SEAL clones to New Copenhagen took an hour. Stripping the Sakura and shipping supplies down to the planet took 2 days. Every morsel of food, be it frozen, dehydrated, powdered, extruded, or fresh, was sent to the planet. Power generators were removed from the ship and sent down to the planet, leaving entire decks without electricity. Weapons, everything that wasn't built into the Sakura's hull, were sent down, including 15 low-gravity tanks. Beds, portable storage facilities, and furniture were sent down. So were cooking and eating utensils. Engineers even scavenged metal and wiring from the wall panels and floors. Yamashiro and Takahashi quietly observed the carnage as the Admiral made his final inspection of the ship.
Admiral on deck!
The crew, about 80 men and 50 SEALs, stood to salute Yamashiro. He returned their salute. Yamashiro wanted to leave. He felt old, even ancient. Yamashiro no longer saw himself as an admiral. The bridge had become a foreign land to him, one that he needed to escape. He nodded to the men nearest the hatch and left, a silent Takahashi at his side.
How much do they know?
The SEALs know everything.
And the sailors?
They know we are going to broadcast into the atmosphere, and that it would be dangerous.
Are you going to tell them?
What should I tell them? It's not a mission, it's a death sentence.
If I tell them what we're really going to do...
Would you blame them?
I can't fight my crew and the aliens at the same time.
I do not envy you, Hironobu. You carry too much weight on your shoulders.
They continued down the hall until they reached the stairs.
I won't carry that weight for long. No more than 3 minutes once we are underway.
They reached the crowded corridors of the bottom deck. With their compound stripped empty and most of the crew off the ship, the SEALs milled about in the halls.
Admiral, sir, Master Chief Oliver was looking for you.
I would like to speak with him.
The SEAL walked off in search of the Master Chief. In his dark suit with his dark skin, the clone disappeared into his surroundings as he hurried down the hall. A moment later, two shadows appeared in the distance. As one shadow drew closer, Admiral Yamashiro also approached. Both men stopped and saluted.
Master Chief, I wish you success.
It's been an honor, sir.
Yamashiro searched the hallway, taking in every detail. This was the last time any of these sights would be seen by surviving eyes.
From this moment on, everything that happens on this ship will be a secret that the dead will take with them.
Admiral, may I make one last request on behalf of my men?
Anything.
Sir, the men and I were wondering.
As Oliver spoke, the hatch behind him opened and light spilled out. Looking over the SEAL's shoulder, Yamashiro saw thousands of men standing at attention in rows. The Master Chief stopped speaking, and Yamashiro stepped around him to look in the doorway. Wearing dress uniforms, the SEALs all faced a dais upon which 10 men waited at attention. On that dais stood a barrel, and on that barrel stood a ceramic bottle of sake and a line of thimble-sized cups.
Sir, if you would give us a proper send-off.
Yamashiro Yoshi bowed to the SEAL clone and marched into the room without saying a word. He had already transmogrified from an officer into a politician. But now he struggled against the tide of his instincts and forced himself to behave like an admiral. He scowled at the men as he stalked past them, neither smiling nor showing his pain. And so the retired admiral climbed the steps of the dais and took his place behind the barrel.
Step forward.
He poured sake into the 12 Ochoko and stood at attention as the men met his gaze. At his order, the men took their cups and he took his. He toasted them.
Drink!
They drank their wine and replaced the cups on the barrel. The SEALs saluted him. Yamashiro, standing at attention, extended his return salute as he looked up and down the rows of men.
I must return to the colony.
Oliver saluted one last time, and Yamashiro left the Sakura. Captain Takahashi Hironobu watched as the sled pulled the transport toward the first atmospheric lock. The metal blast doors closed slowly. Takahashi thought about his wife and how much he missed her. He missed the children, too, of course. If the Morgan Atkins believers had never declared their civil war and the aliens had not invaded the galaxy, the Takahashi family would have remained on Ezer Cree. He would have grown old watching his children mature into adults and start families of their own. He wanted to see his family again, just once before he died. But Earth was at war again, and he could not approach the planet without risking everything. Takahashi was not alone in the landing bay. SEALs and a handful of technicians had come to prepare infiltration pods for the attack. He watched as one Japanese technician and 3 SEALs carried a pod to a computer station. A SEAL attached a line from the computer to the SIP as the tech typed on the screen. Takahashi approached the technician.
Ensign, how many pods do we have?
Sir, I have not checked the inventory, sir.
Go check.
The man saluted and ran. Takahashi wondered if the man would mutiny if he knew the turn that his life was about to take. The captain had complete confidence in the SEALs, though. They knew what was coming. The captain returned their salutes and studied their faces.
As you were.
The SEALs quietly went back to preparing the SIPs, the bombs. They were preparing the very bombs that would end their lives. They were digging their own graves.
Captain Takahashi, sir, we have 1,118 pods, sir.
Prepare 100 pods. I want them in place and charge within the next 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Takahashi watched SEALs wheeling SIPs into the bay. In the darkened landing bay, with a few lights shining in the ceiling and the low glow of the computer stations, Takahashi stood fascinated by the coffin-shaped bombs and the demon-like men preparing them. On his notepad, he had a picture of Yoko, his wife. He stared at her and took courage in the thought that this mission might well protect her. He also knew that the only way he would ever see her again was in death. Takahashi entered the bridge, and Suzuki circled toward him like a bird of prey.
Are we ready to launch?
We just heard from the landing base, sir. The infiltration pods are charged.
Good. And our broadcast engines?
Ready, sir!
Where do you have us broadcasting in?
I programmed the computers to broadcast us into the center of the planet.
Interesting plan, Commander, but it leaves no margin for error.
What could go wrong?
Something will go wrong. Something always goes wrong.
Yes, sir. Would you prefer to enter above one of their cities?
Someplace flat and low. Even if everything goes according to plan, we will still need to avoid their tachyon shield.
The anomaly shattered the cold, bright sky at the edge of the city. 1,000 feet in the air, the inside of the tachyon layer formed a perfectly smooth ceiling above the planet, a silver-white surface as bright as a sun shining through the gauze of clouds. Not designed to fly among such atmospheric abstractions as wind currents and convections, the battleship fumbled in the air. The ship jumped and dropped like a fledgling bird struggling to fly. Holding onto workstations and walls to lock himself in place, Commander Suzuki fought his way to the navigation station. An experienced navigator, he squirmed behind the console and took control of the ship. Seconds passed. Tremors still rocked the Sakura, but Suzuki stabilized the ship.
Landing bay! Landing bay!
Corey Oliver had short legs, but he could run 3 4-minute miles without a break. Now he sprinted down the hall, trying to keep his balance as the deck rose and dropped beneath his feet. A sailor lay on the ground in the fetal position, his arms across his stomach. Oliver leaped over the man, landed, and kept running without looking back. Another sailor stood leaning against a wall for support, a stream of blood pouring from the gashes along his left eye and cheek. He reached a hand out to Oliver, who spun to dodge him and just kept running. The ship fell and bounced. It was a big bounce. Oliver held a hand above his head as the floor dropped from beneath him. His wrist and elbow slammed into the ceiling. The SEAL knew how to land on hard surfaces. Bending his knees, balancing perfectly, he rose to his feet and ran to the stairs, already aware that he had dislocated his shoulder. Cradling his right arm with his left, the clone stumbled to the stairs, then jumped whole flights in his rush to reach the landing bays. He landed hard, bounded face first into the bulkhead, turned and jumped to the next flight. The lights had gone out. The deck was so dark that he would have needed lights, had it not been for the genetic enhancements in his eyes. The air smelled of fire, sweat, excrement, and blood. Men had died. Oliver saw bodies. With the panels removed from the ceilings and the walls, men had flown into girders and piping in the turbulence. Oliver opened the first landing bay and hit the panic button on the communications panel. Showers of sparks shot out of holes in the walls. Bodies and equipment lay scattered like garbage along the floor. Two launching devices had fallen over, the caskets they held now scattered among the bodies on the floor. Aware that he might be entering a room filled with radiation, Oliver ran to one of the SIPs. The stealth vehicle did not have gauges or timers on its smooth outer shell, and the dark matte finish revealed no secrets.
Bridge! Captain, can you hear me? I'm in the landing bay.
What is the situation?
It looks like a tornado just blew through here. Maybe an earthquake.
What about the pods?
I can't tell. It looks bad. The computer stations were smashed.
There was nothing Oliver could do in this landing bay. Whatever had happened to the pods, Oliver could not diagnose or fix the problem without a working computer station. And the stations in this bay had been smashed. Having been designed for deep space travel, the Sakura was not aerodynamic. Unlike airships, she could not glide. If her thrusters faltered, she would drop. Captain Takahashi felt helpless as he watched Suzuki, his second in command, typing maneuvers on the navigation keyboard. Battleships like the Sakura were controlled with computers instead of sticks and throttles. Buttons lit up on the panel, and Suzuki pressed or ignored them.
We can't hover like this for long! She's not made for this! We're down to one third of our fuel!
Takahashi listened, but did not answer. He knew that fuel meant for course corrections would not keep a ship in the air for long. The continuous booster stream needed to keep the big battleship afloat would drain their already three-year-old fuel supply.
The engines are too hot! They're going to melt! We can't do this!
Take us to the shoreline!
Aisa!
The second landing bay had been stripped for the colony. Oliver found an empty chamber, vast and black. No lights shone in the void, not even over the emergency exit. With his genetically enhanced eyes, he could see that the floor was bare. No equipment, no bodies. Other SEALs came to help. Some were injured. One man had broken his right arm, and a nub of bone stuck out of his forearm. He carried a flashlight in his left hand.
You with the flashlight, over here. Follow me.
Oliver led the pack to the third landing bay. There they found the same kind of damage that the Master Chief had seen in the first bay. Oliver also saw something else. He hit the communications button.
Bridge, I'm entering the third bay.
Your pods.
I'm just entering.
We're running out of time, Master.
Yes, sir.
Nearly 100 SEALs entered the bay behind him, some bleeding badly.
You, check the computer stations.
A SEAL stumbled off to look at the toppled stations. A moment later, he returned.
The computer stations are broken.
Did you hear that, sir?
I heard. What happened down there?
They weren't expecting a rough ride, so they didn't secure the launch devices. I don't know how we could have secured them anyway. They're made to fit in transports.
Senior Chief Warren entered the bay and pushed his way through to Oliver.
What can I do?
Take some men and get me a launcher and 12 caskets.
What are you doing with caskets?
That's SEAL speak, sir. Caskets are infiltration pods. I was speaking to one of my men.
What is the condition of the pods? Why haven't they exploded?
It's just a hunch, sir. But I'd say the broadcast disrupted the charging process.
That doesn't make sense. Those pods have been through thousands of broadcasts.
Not when they were charged, sir.
As he spoke, Oliver surveyed the wreckage. One moment everything looked hopeless. Then he saw a transport, and the solution occurred to him in a flash.
I need 7 minutes.
7 minutes? We may not last 1 minute.
I need 7 minutes, sir.
It only takes 3 minutes to charge up the pods, and I'm not sure we can last 3 minutes.
It will take you 7 minutes to charge your broadcast engine, Captain. I think you and your men are going to survive this mission.
Survive? What are you talking about? How are we going to do that? What do you mean we're almost out of fuel? Use the reserves! There have got to be reserves! Master Chief, we aren't going to be around in 7 minutes.
The Sakura took another hard knock. Men and machinery flipped in the air. Oliver was thrown 10 feet in the air and landed badly. But the transport did not move. The transport did not move. It was clamped into a launch sled. The rear hatch of the transport hung open, a gaping maw in the dim light of the bay. Oliver looked back and saw two teams of SEALs wheeling in pods and equipment. He signaled for them to follow him, then trotted into the transport. Fortune smiled upon him in the grimmest of ways. As he started up the ramp, he spotted a launch device and computer station in the darkness of the kettle. No glow rose from the computer screen, and no lights winked along the side of the launch device. But the transport had obviously been powered down, and Oliver thought that the odds were pretty good that both mechanisms still worked perfectly. Bolted into tracks that ran across the floor and ceiling of the transport, the launcher remained fixed. Oliver crossed the kettle and entered the cockpit. Like many of the SEALs, Corey Oliver had received flight training for transports. Hoping the bird had not been abandoned because of mechanical problems, Oliver climbed behind the stick and powered up the control. The board lit up without a hitch. He would fly the transport and launch the SIPs himself. It was a one-man job. Only one man would die. The Sakura and her crew would live.